Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I missed being with you all last week. I hope you all had a lovely, wonderful New Year's Eve celebration. You know, the new year is really going to be something that we all are going to just have to watch and keep an open mind and try to come together whenever we can around the issues that we consider important. I'm not sad to see 2016 go. It was really a challenging year. But the prospects of 2017 are set in motion already to be equally challenging, if not more challenging. So for all of us out there who are on the path of consciousness and eating healthy and doing the right thing for our body, mind, soul, and planet, we are really going to need to step up to the plate and all do our part this coming year and into the future to come together so that we can get the power of the people together, because the billionaires that our upcoming president is putting together to run our country, who have so little experience in government or politics or democracy, it's going to be a challenge. And the only thing that we can combat them with is numbers of people. And so we really have to show up. And there was a great article or a guidebook that was put out called Indivincible. And I'm going to share that in this coming week on my website and put it into my newsletter so that you can all read it. But it's talking about us all coming together, kind of following the model of the Tea Party, which ironically, you know, they did a really good job at starting local and showing up, you know, in small groups, but everywhere, all around the country, to put their campaigns forward. And we need to do the same, except with our more conscious campaigns. And we're going to do that. So, you know, people that I'm talking to are really coming together in an optimistic way, and I invite all of us listeners to do the same. I want to share with you, of course, some things that are going on in and around the news before I introduce to you my guest today, who will be Robert Grillo. He's the author of Farm to Fable and also the founder of a wonderful nonprofit organization called Free from Harm, and he'll be coming on talking to us a little bit in just a little while about his book and what Free from Harm does. So, but first, some of the things going on around the city. You know, this is the time of year that you want to start thinking about bees, if you are at all thinking about raising bees. I know people are always asking us how we do it, and this is, believe it or not, in the winter, the time to start thinking about it. Take a class on beekeeping. You know, most areas have a local beekeeping organization. I know the Long Island Beekeepers Association does. And in Queens, the Brooklyn Grange is running a couple different beekeeping classes. January 18th is their first one, from 6:30 to 8:30. And it's really a good idea to know what you're getting into before you start. So you want to take a class on beekeeping, learn about it first, and then if you decide you want to raise bees, this is the time that you also have to think about ordering a hive. Okay, and all the equipment. You should know that the equipment can be quite costly, so you want to think about all of that. January 20th to the 22nd, NOFA New York, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association, the New York chapter is having their annual winter conference. It's always a great, great weekend up in Saratoga Springs at the local Hilton there. And it's a wonderful time, farmers, producers, food activists, everybody coming together. The only problem with this year's conference is it's taking place on the same weekend as the Women's March in Washington, which is a big, big thing. That's January 21st. If you have not gotten a seat on a bus yet for the Women's March in Washington, you want to do that too. So you're going to have to choose between the NOFA conference or the Women's March in Washington. This year, with our president-elect coming on board, I felt like it was important for me to join my fellow citizens down in Washington, D.C. So I'll be going to the march in Washington on January 21st. Our bus leaves at 4:30 in the morning and won't get back until Sunday morning at like 1 in the morning. So it's a full day thing. You need to pack your lunch, pack your dinner. I know IA Green will be cooking enough food for our whole bus for the way back, a vegan meal, so that when we get back on the bus after being cold, we don't have to depend on, you know, the food stops to get our food. So think about coordinating something like that for your bus. January, let's see, what else? January 29th, Slow Food North Shore, which is our local slow food chapter, is having their New Year's party. We just felt like the holidays and New Year's Eve, it's just always too crazy for all of us and too busy. But by January 29th, you know, all the holiday craziness is gone. The long winter nights have settled in. It's a little bit calmer and more peaceful. And so we will be gathering at the Oyster Bay Brewery on Sunday, January 29th from 5 to 8. And our slow food chapter will be cooking up a full course meal for everybody, along with cocktail hour. So, and we are subsidizing the tickets as well. So the cost is only $25 for members and $35 for non-members. So it's going to be a fun evening. The party's from 5 to 8 where we have a reserved area, but then you're welcome to hang on and stay longer, which I would anticipate we probably will do because we're going to be having so much fun. So please join us on January 29th. You can find tickets on our Slow Food North Shore Facebook page or on our website. January 29th, during the day before you come to the Oyster Bay Brewery, if you'd like to, there is a slow food cook-off, a chili non carne, which is a vegetarian chili contest. If people wanted to sign up to compete, the deadline is January 6th, which is just in a couple days, actually tomorrow, is the deadline to participate. But the actual event is Sunday, January 29th from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. So you can actually do that and then come to our holiday party. And that's in the city at Jimmy's 43, which is a wonderful local venue that hosts many of our slow food events. So that should be fun as well. February 2nd, there is the Food Tank Summit that takes place in Washington, D.C. These are the original ones. Food Tank is a wonderful nonprofit organization. If you don't know about them, you will want to. They've been now spreading out their summits, and they just had one up in Chicago, and they're going to be having one in Boston. But the Food Tank Summit is an opportunity. They bring together over, you know, 36 speakers all day long in the auditorium at George Washington University, and it's just information-packed, and it's really a wonderful, wonderful event. I've gone the last couple of years. Not sure if I'll go to this one, being that the weekend before is the Women's March, and I don't know if I'm up for going down twice, but I'll figure that one out. But anyway, if you are near Washington, D.C., or you would like to make a trek there, it is certainly worth it. February 11th is the second annual City Growers Education Conference in Brooklyn. And this event will bring together educators for a day-long event geared towards facilitating conversations around urban farm education and their best practices. Should be great. It's an all-day event. You can find out more about all of these things on my website. Also on February 11th is the New York Oyster and Beer Festival. And that's taking place at the Tunnel at 11th Street and 28th Street in Chelsea. And those tickets sell out, so you do want to get them if you're interested. Also, Just Food has their conference coming up on March 12th and 13th. And that's always an incredible event. If you're interested in making a proposal to show something there, that deadline is January 16th. But this event takes place Sunday, March 12th and Monday, March 13th up at the Teachers College, Columbia University. And that is also always a great event. And there's lots more, but I don't want to take any more time now. So do check out my website at IE Green for all of these wonderful events that are coming up. Some great things are, you know, in the news. I just read a couple articles that actually were a bit hopeful. In the Times this week. One was about sequestering carbon from different type of plants and facilities, and how we can capture that carbon and use it for more energy. And it just, you know, it seemed like it was a win-win situation, and actually good for business. And the thought was that maybe President-elect Trump will actually see it as a business opportunity and not squash it. So that was a bit helpful. And also, the Brooklyn Borough president, who had very high blood pressure and was in, you know, I think he had some heart disease as well. He just went on to a vegan diet, and in 3 months, all his numbers are back down, and he's cured himself, and he's really promoting a vegan diet now. And that's just always great when somebody in the public eye takes that on, you know, even if the inspiration behind them is, you know, for health reasons. It doesn't really matter what the reason is. It's just so wonderful when we can actually see how that diet can impact one's life, and then they share that information with others, and it's just great to see people's health improve and their energy improve, and when you're feeling good, you just want to share how good you're feeling with everybody else. And our guest will be doing that in a little bit as well. I want to share with you this recipe that I made last week for the holidays, and it's just a great, great showstopper. It's just beautiful when it comes out of the oven. It's a vegan shepherd's pie. I use seitan. You know, we don't have any wheat allergies in my family, so seitan is a great meat substitute, high in protein, really good for you. If you are avoiding wheat, you can, of course, use tempeh or tofu in this recipe instead. I was cooking for a lot of people. This recipe feeds about 15 to 20 guests. I used 5 packages of seitan. Each package was only 8 ounces, so it was not a lot of seitan. If you want to make your own seitan, that's great. I usually do, but in a pinch, Ray's seitan is a great brand, as well as there's others. I used 2 onions that I chopped, 6 carrots that I cut into wedges, and I like cutting my carrots when I'm doing stews. I don't like just slicing them on the round. I actually cut them into chunks on an angle. I learned that with macrobiotic cooking, and it's just, you know, more vibrant, you know, it gives more energy to the carrot, and as a result, more energy to all of us. So it's a nice way of cutting the carrots. 8 portobello mushrooms that I sliced up, 1 butternut squash cubed, 1 red pepper chopped, 1 head of broccoli cut up, 8 parsnips also cut into wedges, 1 bok choy cut up, 1/4 cup of tamari, 2 tablespoons of minced garlic, plus 1 tablespoon of minced garlic that I used later into the mashed potatoes, 1 package of frozen organic petite peas. You could use regular peas if that's what you have, 2 tablespoons of grated ginger, plus 1 tablespoon of minced ginger for another part, 1/2 cup of nutritional yeast, 1/4 cup of Marsala wine, 2 cups of water, 1 cup of chopped parsley, 2 teaspoons of fresh thyme, or you could use 1 teaspoon of dried thyme, 1 tablespoon poultry seasoning. That's just a combination of spices, and if you don't have that, you can make your own up using sage, marjoram, you know, more parsley, thyme, tarragon, all that. Salt and pepper to taste, olive oil for sautéing, and 3 pounds of russet potatoes that I cut into large chunks, and I use that for making the mashed potatoes. So first I started off by sautéing the onions, the parsnips, and carrots in a large stock pot with a little bit of olive oil. I added 2 tablespoons of garlic and 2 tablespoons of ginger, and I cooked that down. Then I added the butternut squash, and I cooked all of those hard root vegetables for about 10 minutes and let them get a head start. Meanwhile, I brought a pot of salted water to a boil for the potatoes, and I cooked the potatoes until they were soft. And you don't want to overcook them or they'll fall apart, but you do want them to be soft enough so that they will mash up well and easily. And you're going to drain those and put them into a large bowl. And I sautéed the remaining tablespoon of garlic in some olive oil until they were just toasted, but you don't want them to get brown. And then I added that to the potatoes along with a quarter cup of olive oil, 4 cloves of garlic, 2 cups of coconut milk, salt and pepper to taste, and I just mashed the potatoes, and that made a really great garlic mashed potatoes, and I just put that onto the side. Then meanwhile, in a cast iron frying pan, I sauteed the seitan in just a little bit of olive oil with the 1 tablespoon of garlic and the tablespoon of ginger that you had put aside. And then once those start getting a little brown, you deglaze it with the Marsala wine and let that simmer for just about a minute. Then you add the seitan to the big pot along with the broccoli, the mushrooms, the peppers, and the bok choy. And put that all into the pot, add the water, add the nutritional yeast and the tamari, add the frozen peas, and let that cook down for about 10 minutes. And then I transferred that to an oven-safe casserole pan, topped it with the mashed potatoes. I brushed the mashed potatoes with a little reserved olive oil just so that they get golden brown, and baked it at 375 for about a half an hour or 40 minutes until the peaks of the mashed potatoes get golden brown. Everything's already cooked, so you're really not re-cooking it, but you're just cooking it till the mashed potatoes get a little crusty on top, and then serve it. And it is just a great, great winter recipe. It's just delicious. So please, if you make it, I always love hearing from everybody feedback on how the recipe is. So please share it with me. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest to all of you, Robert Grillo. He is the author of Farm to Fable and the founder and director of Free from Harm, which is a 501c3 organization promoting farmed animal rescue, education, and advocacy. Free from Harm's mission is to expose animal agriculture's impact on non-human animals, vulnerable communities, and the environment. And as a marketing communications professional for over 20 years, Robert worked on large food industry accounts, and that's where he acquired some of his behind-the-scenes perspective and food branding and marketing experience, which informs this book, Farm to Fable. And this is his first book, and it's just really great, and it really gets you thinking as to why do we eat animals, and what is it that has said that it's okay to kill animals all these years. So anyway, Robert, are you with me?
I am, yes. Hi, Bhavani. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Thank you so much
for joining me today.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
So in reading your book, it was just, it's really, really interesting to just step back from, our normal everyday acceptance of what the majority of people do, eating animals, and question as to why. I mean, I remember this little YouTube video that was going around of this cute little kid. I think he was in Turkey or something, of just going, this is an animal, this is a chicken, why are we eating it? And so often people say, I don't eat chickens, I eat chicken, and it's like the minute you say, do you eat chickens? It makes it feel like it's an animal, but if you say I eat chicken, it sounds like it's a product. And so it's really different how you word it. And if you ask kids, do you want to eat chickens or do you want to eat pigs? And they're going to say no. But if you say, you want some chicken? You want some pork? They might say yes.
Yeah.
So it's interesting if you actually give a child a choice and explain to them, their natural inclination, I think, is to not eat it.
It does seem to be the case. And there has been, some research into that too, which I kind of explore a little bit. You may have come across a little bit of that in my book, where some research seems to indicate that children have kind of like a no sense of discriminating based on color or sex or species, and that they have kind of an open mind. And when it comes to animals, that they don't understand chickens, turkeys, cows, and pigs as being species that we should treat drastically differently than dogs and cats and other animals in our lives until the adult world teaches them. So,
right. So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, the book came about after about 4 years of a presentation that I had developed, which I call Farm to Fable now as well. And what I was doing with this presentation is like kind of a visual gallery of examples of the various types of fictions and fictional devices and stories that popular culture tells us about consuming animals and our right to consume animals. And what I realized is that, you know, I had compiled quite a bit of work on the subject, and then a publisher approached me and said, hey, have you thought about, you know, writing a book on this? And I said, well, kind of, but, you know, then he suggested that we move forward, and I thought that was great. That's perfect timing. And so what I did is I, you know, took an inventory of all of several years of writing and all of these different examples I had of fictions, and realized that I somehow had to put this all together and make a coherent case for, you know, how people could digest these fictions and how they fit into categories and why they're important, not just for the general public to understand, but also for environmental and animal advocates. I think there's definitely some special takeaways for them.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say are the key questions the book seeks to answer? I mean, I guess,
sure.
You know, of course, the cultural forces that drive our food choices, but what else?
Sure. So, you know, the book, the main question that I grapple with in the book is, how is it that in an age when many of us couldn't easily make other choices, do we still consume animals? And I think that's where the fictions come in, that, you know, these fictions are so ubiquitous in our culture that, you know, whenever there's a doubt or a question as to whether this is still, you know, an ethical practice, there's these fictions that come in and say, hey, keep doing what you're doing because it's perfectly natural and normal and necessary and all those things. And so the book seeks to answer the question, why in an age when we could easily make other choices do we continue to consume animals? And I think the answer is that popular culture and the industries, the animal exploitation industries, you know, have created a kind of a matrix where, you know, wherever we turn, there's examples of these fictions influencing our food choices, whether it's going to the grocery store and the whole retail experience, or whether it's going out to certain kinds of like farm to fork restaurants where, you know, the perception of animals is that they're very willing. And if we treat them well, then it's fine to, you know, to consume them, or whether it's going online and just seeing lots of visuals, lots of stories about the right way to consume animals, the humane way to do it. All of these things collectively kind of condition us to continue that practice, even when we don't need to, and even when we would be a lot better off not doing it. And of course, you know, animals as well would not be subjected to the harm that of course is inevitable in consuming them.
Uh-huh. Now your professional background kind of informs some of your work around this book. Can you share with my listeners what your professional background is and how that does inform the book?
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of it's tragically comic in a way that you know, many years ago I started out working as a creative professional graphic designer, and I would kind of bounce from one freelance gig to another. And so there was lots of work at the time in food advertising because Chicago's kind of known for that. And so I would, you know, spend 6 months here, 3 months there. And at one point I spent about a year in an agency where I found myself working on things like McDonald's Happy Meal boxes. And at the time, you know, it didn't occur to me that there was anything strange or weird about it, because I was under the spell of that same kind of brainwashing. I didn't see anything wrong with the idea of portraying happy and fun farm animals on the package of a box that contained the body parts of an animal that likely lived a miserable life. And so what I realized, you know, what I realize now is that here we are marketing this to children, which, you know, children are the most vulnerable, influential audience. We're intentionally deceiving them into, you know, showing one thing on the package and yet having a completely different reality. So this was kind of the backdrop for for the book, I suppose you could say, and for my awakening later in life. So after about, you know, 15, 20 years of working in that kind of like freelance environment, I started getting very interested in food and environment and certain kinds of documentaries and investigations I witnessed made me realize that our food system and our exploitation of animals was just absolutely horrendous, and I could no longer contribute to it. And then I felt like I needed to become actively involved. And so I thought, okay, what skills can I use to that end? And I thought, well, I'm a writer, and I'm also, you know, I have this marketing background, so I can, you know, I can help people see what they're not seeing in the very sophisticated marketing and branding that influences us. So that's kind of where the, you know, my background fits in with what I'm doing now.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I've discussed many times and have had different guests on over the years, talking about marketing to children. I mean, it is just, you know, marketing of meat is one thing, but also the marketing of sugar and just foods that are just so unhealthy. You talk about, you know, children being so vulnerable, and they are. And I don't remember, I don't have the statistics in front of me, but the amount of hours of direct marketing that is, you know, directly geared for children, for the consumption of foods that are unhealthy and that will make them sick, meat included, is just unbelievable, unbelievable. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, people need to mobilize around and get changed, because, you know, the diets, the rate of obesity and diabetes amongst young children is just outrageous, and it's all about the marketing, and it's just amazing. So it's wonderful when someone who has that marketing ability and knowledge can actually use it towards some good. So so before you wrote your book, you actually used that experience and that ability to start Free From Harm, correct?
Right. Yeah, that was my first kind of foray into exploring my interest in food and popular culture and animals and the environment. And at first it was very random. I mean, I was soaking in a lot of information and knowledge that I was learning about from all these different groups. And I started a website because I have some background in website marketing. And I thought, okay, I'm going to create a site that hopefully I can make successful and get a good presence online. So over time, the focus became animals and agriculture and how animals are exploited and how we can, you know, the case for why we can move beyond this. So that's where I am now. But one of the other things that was a real catalyst for me when I started the site and started this whole process was in 2009, I adopted three baby chicks from a school chick hatching project. So, you know, these schools, they use these little chicks as teaching tools, right? And so they teach children how eggs hatch into chicks, and then mm-hmm. there's no home for these chicks. And some of them are roosters. And so when they grow up, of course, no one can have or need, no one wants roosters, and they don't lay eggs. So you find, you know, that these schools are unprepared for adopting these birds out or finding some, you know, solution to this problem.
And if you think about it, I think every single kindergarten or first grade does that little experiment of hatching chickens.
Yeah,
you know, I remember it from when I was a kid.
Yeah. But I raised these chicks from, you know, days old to adulthood. And I let them, you know, they were here and they were members of our family. I treated them like most people would treat any other companion animal, like a cat or a dog. And what that experience taught me was something incredibly valuable, that turkeys, chickens, cows, and pigs, in other words, the species that we exploit so horrendously, when we allow them into our lives as companions, they respond just like our cats and dogs would. They bond with us. They attach with us. They form lasting relationships with us. They have incredibly, you know, diverse and unique personalities. They're playful. They're a joy to have around, just like it is a joy for us to have cats and dogs. And so that experience was incredible for me, because what I had been taught all the way up to that point in my life was that these animals had no capacity for that, that they were something completely less and inferior than that, and that's why we treated them so much worse. But, you know, the experience, the firsthand experience of raising them really completely made me realize that that was all false.
Uh-huh. You didn't have them in your house, though, right? They still were outdoor. They were outdoor chickens, right? Living a chicken
one
life.
One of them... Some of them were in and out of the house. There was one in particular named Doris that was very attached to me, and she was in the house most of the time. She was more attached to me and was more interested in being around me than she was the other chickens. So her and
really?
I developed a kind of very special attachment.
Wow. So then where did it grow from there? So after you saved these three chicks, was any of them a rooster or no?
One of them turned out to be a rooster, and we didn't, you know, you don't know that until they're about 4 to 6 months old and they start crowing or they start developing certain physical traits that indicate that they're a rooster. So, yeah, and then I found a place, I found a permanent home for him on a sanctuary, luckily, but it was pretty tough because he was a really sweet rooster, and we had developed quite a friendship, so... Yeah, that was kind of tough. And then since then, you know, we've rescued many chickens from urban areas. What's happened is that, you know, just like with cats and dogs, you know, this whole backyard chicken craze has created a lot of casualties of people that thought they could handle and commit to caring for the chickens that they either purchased or whatever for eggs. And what happened is that they got roosters by accident, or they had situations where they could no longer care for them. And so lots of them end up becoming homeless. And so we get calls a lot about these birds that are found in city streets, back alleys, in cemeteries, in forest preserves. And we try to rescue them and find them permanent homes.
Mm-hmm. And what else does Free From Harm do? I know I went to the website and it seemed like you've had your hands in a lot of things there.
Yeah, our site is pretty prolific. There's about 450 pages on the site right now, and that's really our focus. It's our, you know, that's what we do well. We're unlike many other larger, you know, advocacy organizations that do a lot of community outreach and are involved in all facets of advocacy. We really feel like our online activism and presence is the thing we do best and that we should kind of stick with. So we're strong in social media, in Facebook, Twitter, and building our website presence and building awareness online. So we have this kind of really interesting audience that's global, and we hear from people all around the world. You know, it's really interesting to find people from just all four continents with a similar common shared concern interest in the cause. It's really phenomenal.
It is. Robert, let's take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to go back to your book and talk about some of the, the cultural fictions that perpetuate the animal consumption, and explore that a little bit more with everybody. Okay, so everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Robert Grillo, author of Farm to Fable, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Robert Grillo, and we're talking about his book, Farm to Fable. Robert, you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. So let's talk about how popular culture perpetuates the fictions around animal consumption and how that continues our consuming behavior.
Yeah, so one thing I'd like to point out just because of your show is, and the network, is that I think a lot of the fictions that we use to try to justify animal exploitation are also, though, many of them are the same that we use to exploit vulnerable human groups and ones that we consider inferior. So I think we have a special connection with other social movements that you talked about earlier, about the Women's March on Washington. And so I think, one person pointed out to me that I was kind of griping about the fact that my book came out right around the election results, around that same time, because I thought, well, the Trump is going to dominate the news, and this is not a good time for me to have the book out. But then someone pointed out something that really changed my thought on that, and they said this is the best time that your book could come out, because the fictions that Trump is using, that whole propaganda kind of framework, I can see so many of the same fictions he's using that we use to justify exploiting and consuming animals. So I just wanted to point that out, like kind of in the beginning of this discussion. And then I can give you kind of some examples of fictions. I have a group that I call foundational fictions. And so those are the first
foundational,
that I talked about
did you
in
say?
Book.
I'm sorry, Robert, did you say
something?
Foundational?
Yeah, I call it foundational. The foundational fictions, because without them, they're kind of like the ones that others are built upon. And so like for one big one is consent. It's what I call consent. And so consent is the idea that animals are just willing participants in whatever it is that we'd like to do with them. And this is an ancient fiction that goes all the way back to when we started domesticating animals. It became a story that we told ourselves that, okay, the whole process of domestication sounds like a very nice word, but it's actually going into the wild and capturing and confining wild animals and breeding them in a way that makes them more submissive and subservient to us. So it's really dominating animals and bending them to our will so that we can then use them as a resource, or in ancient times as actual pieces of property, as currency, right? So consent is this idea that animals are willing participants. And in modern times, all we have to do is go to the store to see examples of this. One is the very benevolent-looking packaging of organic valley milk products. What do we see on the cover of that package? We see family farms, their children and family farmers affectionately petting their cows.
Well, you see that even on non-organic milk.
Right. Yeah, with that as well. And with, so consent is everywhere. Without consent, if we believe that animals are consensual, then it's just a matter of how we treat them, because they don't mind being used. That's the assumption. is we can, they don't mind being used as a resource. So then it's just a matter of treating them humanely. And that's why, you know, humane washing is a fiction that we see that is so prevalent today, which focuses just on treatment and ignores use altogether. Of course, when it comes to human beings, we fully recognize that using human beings in a way that it's against their interests is unethical. But we haven't made that leap with other animals. And so I explore that quite a bit in my book, the whole humane washing. Humane washing is what kind of is animal agriculture's attempt to kind of intercept the discourse away from veganism, away from eating plants, and saying to the people that are right on the threshold that you can still consume animals with a clear conscience because there's a right way, there's a humane way to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right.
So those are two of the big fictions that of the many that I talk about in the book.
Uh-huh. So you don't think that your belief is that there is no humane way. Like even if you have Rosie the cow as your family cow and you are milking it, you don't think that she's okay with you milking it, even if you're doing it as a family pet kind of thing.
Sure. Well, see, the thing is like we just assume like that cows just produce milk. And so there, if we actually look a little closer, first of all, we have to impregnate the cow in order to have her lactate and produce milk.
Sure.
And that milk was actually intended for her offspring. So where are her offspring? Well, you know, in India, there's an ancient practice of having a family cow, right? So people say that this is the right way. They care very much that the cow is actually sacred in Hindu culture. But there's a dark side to that. So there's an ancient practice in India that no one really wants to talk about. But what they do is when a female is impregnated and she bears, after carrying her baby for 9 months, she bears a male, which is of no use to, of course, a family that's having a cow for milk, that there's a practice of taking the male calves to the temple and offering, you know, making an offering to the temple. Now, what happens is the temple doesn't do anything for these babies, these males. They leave them without food or water in many cases. They tie them up to a post in the incredible heat and offer them no water or food, or they sell them to Muslim butchers. So there's this long practice of that. The males are unwanted, or they just end up on the street. So you have a huge feral cow population in India of cows that are just eating garbage, plastic bags. There's actually a documentary called The Plastic Cow. It's a really fascinating documentary about, you know, cows. Yeah, you can't slaughter them, you can't kill them in India, but then they end up as feral animals eating garbage,
right?
Essentially. So there's a
dark side to... Yes, I was in India and I did witness that.
You did?
Oh yeah, lots of cows just eating.
You probably know something about this. Yeah.
Uh huh.
So, So the I guess the short answer is no. There really isn't a humane way to exploit someone who doesn't want to be exploited, who doesn't want to be used against their will, who produces milk for their offspring, or who has bodily integrity and wants to be able to live a life according to their own interests. And I think we should extend that same right to other species other than just ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so humane washing, give us some other fictions that we all...
Sure.
Not we all, but many, the majority of people accept as fact.
Well, you know, one of the things that is very necessary in order to kind of, you know, indoctrinate people into eating animals is a fiction I call commodification. So just to give you an example, when I was at a farmer's market in Marin County, California, I was, you know, presented with all these beautiful flowers and produce and, you know, how these farmers markets are. And then I walked to the back, and there's this little cage of little baby chicks. And there's a sign above their head that says $2 each. Now, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because here is the best-case scenario for animals. It's the organic mecca of our country, Marin County, California. And the value of an entire lifetime of experience of a bird is only $2, less than the price of a tube of toothpaste that we will use and throw away in a few weeks. That says something incredibly important to me about the value we place on these animals, even in the best case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So commodification is one that I think we need to really believe in, seeing them as commodities and not individuals that have a life of their own interests. Another one is euphemism, the words and the language we use. So, for example, since we talked about cows earlier, we say breeding cows is artificial insemination. Well, that sounds like a pretty pleasant word because in the human case, it's an elective procedure. So women who are having difficulty having given birth can elect to have this procedure done that could help them become pregnant. And some women say, well, it doesn't feel much different than having a pap smear. So it's pretty non-invasive. But in the case of dairy cows, it means, shoving an arm up a cow's rectum, basically, and then shooting a semen gun in her vagina at the same time. And this is done repeatedly in the cow's life until, you know, she can become pregnant. It's a very invasive procedure. So, we use euphemisms like mute. The word mute is a perfect example. Nobody really thinks about what the word meat means, but when we call someone a piece of meat, if we call a woman a piece of meat, we mean that she's an object of, you know, she's good for only one thing. When we say that to an animal, though, a female animal, for example, we don't think of it as an insult. But actually, when you reduce a being to just a slab of meat, you're just saying that that being, that individual, is their only value is something to consume, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting how the power of these words that we use every day that we really don't consider, you know, how they denigrate the identity of animals to the level that we can just consider them an object of consumption.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, you also use the movie The Matrix as a metaphor for some of our food choices. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's interesting because I know the Wachowskis because they live in my neighborhood, and they're the Wachowskis created the movie The Matrix. And the reason why I love this as a metaphor is because the movie is all about this artificial world called the Matrix, which most people, the humans that live in this world, don't know that they're under the control of the Matrix. And the Matrix is this artificial intelligence that the human race created but doesn't realize that is now controlling the human race. So at one point in the movie, Neo, who's the, you know, protagonist, he's believed to be the chosen one. He's the one that can actually liberate the human race out of the Matrix. So at one point, he's given an ultimatum, and he's told, you can take the red pill or the blue pill. If you take the red pill, you'll learn the truth about the Matrix and how to defeat it. If you take the blue pill, you're never going to know the truth. And you're just going to live like everyone else in this kind of state of ignorance. So he decides to take the red pill. And that's really interesting to me because, you know, our food, when it comes to our food choices, I think most of us take the blue pill, right? Because most of us take the blue pill because it serves an important function. It tells us what we want to see And it shows us what we want to see, and it tells us what we want to hear about animals, that they're well treated, that we can do it the right way, and that they don't suffer or they suffer minimally. So that's what we want to believe, and taking the blue pill just reinforces that. But some of us take the red pill and decide that as natural truth seekers, which I think humans are, at some point, when an injustice is intolerable to a point that it becomes intolerable, then society starts shifting away from denial and more towards truth and embracing truth. Because ultimately, I think our goal is to have a more just, less violent, less harmful world. And especially in the age we live in today, I can't think of anything more important than that. And I think we have to look at animals, other animals, as part of that whole dynamic of violence versus peace and justice. I mean, because what we do on a daily basis and what we eat obviously has a lot to do with those values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, you also mentioned, in the book, the difference between visiting animals at a sanctuary versus visiting animals at a farm, and how that can really impact someone's understanding of the difference of an animal living in their natural state and allowing to be the way that they are meant to be versus living mm-hmm. in a farm. You want to just touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so sanctuaries aren't perfect. They're man-made environments, too. They're kind of a Band-Aid, in a way. They're a way to give animals a second chance at life. So what we do for farmed animals that were in completely desperate situations, that were discarded by the farming industry or by backyard chicken keepers, is to give them a second chance at life. But, of course, we can't provide them with a perfect world. We can only try to give them as natural a life as possible. And by virtue of being domesticated over centuries and centuries, domesticated animals today are at best completely dependent on us for their very survival needs. So that's not really that's a very vulnerable position to be in, to be completely dependent on someone else for you to survive or to have well-being, to make sure you have enough food or water or that you're sheltered from and protected from predators or from the weather. I just like to say that because sanctuaries aren't perfect. But then when we go to farms and we witness animals on farms, we're not really, these aren't places where animals are really allowed to give them to express themselves as the individuals that they are. So like I said earlier, when you raise them as companions, you get to see their individual personalities. When you're on a farm, there's a very specific purpose for those animals being there. And the very nature of farming and regarding animals as resources negates the idea that they're individuals with personalities. So it represses their true nature. Whereas on a sanctuary, right. You might actually get to see what Wilbur the pig is like, and that, has a certain personality that's different from, Winnie the pig, So mm-hmm. like they, two different pigs could have very different natures and different personalities, and they'd actually have an opportunity to express those differences. And people might walk away from a visit to a sanctuary and say, oh my goodness, I never realized that there's such individuality and complexity in these animals. Whereas someone will walk away from a farm and look at animals across a fence or, a group of animals and say, well, they all look alike. And they all, they all look kind of sad, or they just don't. They seem kind of expressionless. They seem like they don't. Well, the reason for that is the conditions under which they're living, not because they don't have the personalities, not because they don't want to express who they are, but because the environment itself stifles that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. Well, the book is, you know, really, really great because it's just getting people to think, you know, like, of course, the one that I love is that, you know, you need to eat meat to get enough protein. And, well, we all know that that's not true. But so many people really believe that that is true, you know, that they'll die if they don't eat meat. And
a recent study that came out showed Fonalytics said that 66% of Americans still believe that they need to consume animal products to survive.
Right. Right.
So
it's, well, it's, you know, and one of the things that I talk about a lot is, you know, the interconnectedness of the influences. I mean, I believe the U.S. Dairy Association is still in charge of funding all of the health education at schools or something. You know, at least that is how it used to be. And so, you know, if it's their job to fund what we learn in school about health, well, you know, milk is going to be really important. And so we need to get, you know, special interest money out of you know, what we're taught, and that, you know, start making a big difference. But that's certainly not going to happen in this new administration. So we all have to be, as I was saying earlier, more vigilant than ever and really, really question everything. And that's one of the reasons I really love your book.
He wants to put a fast food giant in charge of agriculture. I mean, that's like, you know, it's almost like everyone he seems to put as a pitch as a cabinet leader is like doesn't believe in their role. It doesn't believe in the mission of that particular department. Isn't that incredibly cynical?
Well, we're just about out of time, so Robert, really quickly, tell everybody how they can get in touch with you and find your book.
Please look for my book on Amazon, and the website in general for our organization is freefromharm.org.
Wonderful. Robert, thanks so much. And everyone listening, thank you for joining us. Continue to have a wonderful, wonderful new year. Bring light to the darkness of winter and have a great rest of the week. And I'll see you all again next week.